All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a powerful show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Trevor Timm, a co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's a journalist, activist, and lawyer, and he'll talk about the indictment of Julian Assange and the next dangerous steps in Trump's war on the press. We're also going to be featuring a few other little messages inserted here and there, so stay tuned for that. But opening the show up, I am really, I'm eager to get into this one. We're going to be talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Now, Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions of people did not, and he has spent the last 10 years studying fascism. He wants to scare us all, as someone said. I actually think he wants to ring the bell, and I like that Spike Lee film, Ring the Bell, and shouting to people, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he's here to talk with us about Donald Trump, the rise of fascism, what it means, and how people should be reacting. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I have 100 questions for you, okay?
Shoot.
Okay. I saw a clip in an event you did in Chicago, and you talked there. You started with a story about your father sitting you down and telling you about the reality of America and the America First movement. And, you know, I guess actually I hadn't been studied up on all this in the America First movement and the relationship between that and what your dad was telling you and what's going on in the country today. Let's talk about that.
So we have a president who's explicitly referencing the America First movement. If you look at history, if you look at, say, Bradley Hart's recent book, Hitler's American Friends, it's got like 5 chapters, I think, in it. One of the chapters is on the America First movement. The Nazis thought the America First movement and its representative, Charles Lindbergh, its spokesperson, was their main hope in the United States. I mean, we had a very healthy fascist movement. It obviously had clear links to a homegrown movement, the Ku Klux Klan, whose ideology is very much overlaps with German fascism. And we had this long history of white supremacy, white nationalism. I mean, it's not a history. It's our present. It's something that the United States always struggles with. And Charles Lindbergh writes in the Reader's Digest that it's time to build our walls, build our ramparts high to protect the white race against the Mongol horde, against the Persian horde, the Arab horde. You know, this is a long history of racial demagoguery against non-whites, and that's what we're tapping into in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, it's very heavy because it's like there's that, what you're talking about in terms of this long history, and then there is the reality of today, which it really struck me because this, the aspect of people actually needing to know that what is the history of fascism and what it is in the U.S. and the fact that it isn't something foreign. It has a long and deep history. But the problem is that there's, you know, people don't realize even in this sense. I mean, one of the things that really surprised me in reading your book was you made a point that actually it's not like the U.S. is free from all this or is just following what happened in Germany and other places, but that actually...
Vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Germans were deeply influenced by the U.S. case. I mean, people don't understand what an outlier the United States was with its one-drop rule about that you were not white, you were black if you had one drop of blackness. As James Whitman discusses in Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg lawyers carefully studied our anti-miscegenation laws and based the Nuremberg laws upon them, although they decided that one drop was untethered from reality and went instead with one-eighth. You're Jewish if you're one-eighth Jewish. So our racial laws were even too extreme for the National Socialists. Now, of course, time has changed, and we've fought. The story of America is the story of our struggle with white supremacy, and it's always a difficult struggle, and it's very slow movement and slipping back. Look at the PBS documentary Reconstruction. I mean, I was taught in school that Reconstruction failed. After the Civil War, they give 4 million black people to vote, and then suddenly there are black congressmen and senators and people in the state legislatures, and they panic and they remove the vote. And I was taught that was because black people couldn't self-govern. So we have this long history, and what we're seeing with Trump is an aspect. Trump is very American, but he's also very fascist.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a minute, because there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you first. You know, this thing, you're starting to talk about, and the whole idea that Look, for me, it was really interesting. In reading your book, it was, and I really recommend that people get this book. It's well worth sitting down, reading it, and rereading it. And it's Jason Stanley, How Fascism Works. You know, one of the things that really struck me there was that there really is this sort of, all the various structural problems in the U.S. and how that actually brought people forward, not in a way to actually deal with all this stuff, in a way that could actually, you know, be, I don't know, whatever you would call it, digging in to try and do things in the right way and get, you know, get all this other stuff settled. It actually, you have people, the structural problems in the U.S. are bringing forward people that are turning to, helping them turning to fascism, which is really, you know, that is something I think people don't understand here.
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear in the literature on European fascism. Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, chapter 10, is all about how fascism emerges when people become lonely, when you break down labor movements, when you break down movements that bring people together to better their lives. Then they, when they become lonely and isolated due to the deprivations of capitalism, then they turn for solace to identity movements that give them false, fake hopes of meaning. I mean, I don't think the thing about fascism is it's not good for white people. You know, it's not good for the people that it claims to be good for. As Hannah Arendt says, you know, fascism, you know, claims to advance the race, but in fact, it's just advancing the interests of those who are making these false promises. But those false what happens in these moments when people are isolated and afraid about their economic insecurity, is that they turn to, they desire to see some kind of victory. And they'll sacrifice their own well-being if they think that their enemies, the liberals, the elites, are having to be, are being humiliated and are being aggravated. So that's fascist politics. Fascist politics says, we're not going to give you anything. You're not going to get anything out of this, but what you will get is we're going to torment the people you hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's jump into this, the structure of fascism and why it's so dangerous. I mean, that's something I think people really need to understand pretty deeply.
Right. So my book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a different aspect of fascist politics. And for me, you know, the United States is not governed like it's not a fascist government right now. We have elements of that with our prison industrial system, with the carceral state. But we're not a fascist country by any means. But we're talking about political tactics. Fascism is best thought of as a set of political tactics that breaks down democratic ideals. Let's begin with what democratic ideals are. Democratic ideals are liberty and equality. And both of those are based on truth. If you've been lied to, nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to, so that's why they're not free. They'll vote for dear leader every time because they've been lied to. Liberty requires truth. Equality requires truth because truth is, speaking truth to power is how you equalize. So a democratic culture requires people to have respect for the truth because that's how you equalize. So it requires, like, if a very powerful person lies and someone says, you're lying, that very powerful person will be humiliated, and if they lie too much, they won't be able to participate in public life. If you lose that, you lose your democratic culture, because then a powerless person can't call out a powerful person. So let me start by running down quickly the 10 chapters. The first tactic is the mythic past. All of fascist tactics are based on a big lie, because that's the way to get you to detach from the truth. So the mythic past, we were once great, but we've been humiliated on the national stage. So you could see President Trump did this in the 2016 election. Obama bowed and scraped. He didn't throw American power around. He humiliated us. We're going to return to our greatness. We were once great, you know, wink, wink about when that once was. Propaganda. There's a certain kind of propaganda that is very clear in fascism when things mean they're opposite. Like, all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. Even though the fascists themselves are more corrupt than anyone else, they tar their opponents with corruption because they say this is useful for many reasons, but corruption means the wrong people are in charge. Chapter 3 is anti-intellectualism. You attack the press and the universities. So you should always worry when there's a systematic attack on the universities for being left-wing ideological indoctrination centers. So you attack the intellectual bastions, the press, for peddling leftism and liberalism under the guise of objectivity. You attack the universities for being like dens of Marxism and cultural Marxism. In Hungary, they just shut down the best university in Hungary, Central European University, for gender ideology and liberalism. So you always have to worry when there's a big attack on the universities and the press. Chapter 4, unreality. You float conspiracy theories. My first New York Times piece in 2011 was about birtherism, because knowing the history of fascism, that panicked me. When people, there's a way that conspiracy theories work. All the evidence against the conspiracy theories is actually treated as evidence for them. So the way the Nazis floated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jews own the presses, they run the universities, they run the film and theater industry. And then when you said, when the presses refused to report on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was more evidence. Look, the press is not reporting that the Jews run the press. That just shows the Jews run the press. Similarly, President Trump in 2012 said, you can tell CNN is owned by Obama because they're controlled by Obama because they don't report on birtherism. So unreality, you destabilize people. So nobody knows what the truth is anymore, and they forget the truth. And they're like, I don't care about the truth. I know my guy is lying, but he's my guy. He's us. And his lies drive the other side crazy, and that's what I like. You know. So that's the fascist political sphere. It's just us versus them. Reality's irrelevant. Chapter 5 is hierarchy. You know, equality is a myth. Feminism is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black Lives Matter is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black people are seeking to take over. They don't want equality. So you represent the dominant group feels victimized. Trump supporters think the most victimized group in America are white Christians. So that goes into Chapter 6, victimhood. You have this incredible tapping of victimhood of the dominant group. The Nazis were like, the Germans are the most persecuted people in the world. We lost our empire. So you have this sense, you cultivate the sense that the persecuted people who are losing their traditions are the dominant group. And what are they victims of? Chapter 7 is law and order. They're victims of crime, of gangs, because those foreigners, and they're bringing in crime and drugs and gangs. So in Austria, Kickl, the far-right minister, he went around and told the police stations they're not allowed to talk to the mainstream press unless to report rapes of Austrian women by immigrants. So you create panicked fear about gang members and rapists, and that leads to the next chapter, which is sexual anxiety. You know, what crime do they do? Well, they do the crime of, they're rapists. We have to protect our women, and that's why we need a strong leader, because the strong leader is going to build a wall and protect our women from the foreigners. And you raise panic about homosexuality. You raise panic about turning boys into girls, because it's manlyhood that's prized in fascist politics. It's patriarchy. And then, you know, the first real fascist politics we had in recent years was Sarah Palin. So that hit the Chapter 9, Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are the places of decadence and liberalism. That's where everyone mixes together. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf is called Mein Time in Vienna. And he says, in Vienna, there were foreigners everywhere, foreign languages, and Jews, and more Jews. So the hated out-group always lives in the cities. Think of what the expression inner city means in America. Cities are where black people live. It's where the immigrants live. And so you create the real Americans live in the countryside, rural versus urban divide. And Chapter 10 is called Arbeit macht frei, which was emblazoned on the gates of Auschwitz. Work shall make you free. Time and time again, the out-group is always lazy. They're drains on the state. And you need to make them work for free in order to earn a work ethic. And that is at the heart. So that's why the idea in Nazi Germany was that Jews were lazy and never did any work. And they just got money because the government gave them, they worked in banking, and they just got money from interest and just were lazy. And you had to force them to work to give them a work ethic. And that's what is happening in our prison system right now. And then you target labor unions, because labor unions, you know, are about, you know, making workers' lives easier. But you need to break down labor unions, because labor unions forge connections across racial divides.
Yeah, this is incredible, actually. And let me make a quick announcement here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. So let's get back into it. Now, Jason, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and you've been hitting at some of it, but there's this point about why exactly this is so dangerous, you know, because you're thinking like, okay, you go through this, you go through the, you have Lindbergh, all these people early on talking about fascism. Fascism raises its head, you know, throughout the decades that we've been around, that we've been alive over, you know, since the 1920s all the way up or 19 and even 1930. You have, who was it? Is it Bannon that talked about it's going to be a good year because it's a lot like 1930, something like that.
He said we're going to, in the Hollywood Reporter interview, he said it's going to be exciting like the 1930s. Yeah. Now he's always winking. So, yeah, that's the decade he goes back to, and that's the decade where the United – now, it's tricky because Bannon has plausible deniability. He'll say, I meant the New Deal, but I'm skeptical that he meant the New Deal.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical. It's sort of – yeah. But the thing is like when you and that gets into this character of the fascist tactics. And, you know, it is really – there's something that you keep bringing up in your book that really struck me, that fascism seeks to replace truth by power, and that there's a very particular method to doing that. Let's talk about that.
So – the method is you get people, you try to replace, so truth balances out loyalty. If we recognize the truth, if we recognize facts, so I don't mean like a deep truth. So people think that the Russian language makes a distinction between deep truth and truth. So that's why that covers propaganda. You lie, but you lie to reveal a deeper truth. I'm talking about just facts. So the enemy of fascism is just facts, just ordinary facts. Because ordinary facts, if everyone has loyalty to ordinary facts, then, you know, it's hard to get away with stuff. They're just ordinary facts. And you have to have, a democratic culture requires that people are humiliated when they lie about ordinary facts. But what you try to do is you try to say, look, the whole system is corrupt. Everybody's lying. Think of Fox News's slogan, old slogan, fair and balanced. Everyone knew Fox News was not fair and balanced. The point of that slogan was to suggest that no one is fair and balanced, that Fox News is just as fair and balanced as everyone else, meaning not fair and balanced at all, because everyone is corrupt, everyone is lying. So you break down trust. You break down trust between citizens. So everyone is just like, okay, I don't know what's true anymore. I don't even care what's true. I just care about my guy winning, and I care about my guy winning and humiliating those liberal cosmopolitan elites and making them feel miserable, what we call owning the libs. And if you go back throughout fascist politics to the 1930s, to the German and Italian fascist movements, that's what it was about. It's about humiliating the elite. It was about bringing them down and, you know, and doing it in the service of your guy gaining power. And so it's like following sports teams. Sports is healthy because it takes away our fascist inclinations and focuses them on something it's fine to root for. It's totally fine for me to be like a total supporter of the New York Knicks because, you know, painful as it is in recent years, you know, that's my team. But that's not the attitude you want to bring to politics. The Democratic Party is not your team. The Republican Party is not your team. The truth is your team. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise conspiracy theories to try to humiliate the opponent, to try to just tar them with worst things ever, and just make politics into spectacle and show instead of – that's the other thing that we find. So you find Arendt talking about that all the time. She said, in fascism, people are glued to the screen. They're no longer – the news is no longer the news. The news is entertainment. The news is like, what's happening now in the ever-crazy turmoil of the administration? Who's in? Who's out? And then no one is following anymore. They get addicted to this, like, spectacle of excitement. And then, you know, instead of, like, the boring policy of healthy democratic give and take.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, as you're talking, I kept going back to this, where you get, you know, you talk about in the book, you talk about, you know, Hitler and value comes from victory and struggle, as you've been pointing to, but that also that if you want to get rid of political equality, you actually, this is what you do. You get rid of people's respect for the truth, which is really an interesting thing to posit.
Absolutely. The truth is much more important than people realize, and people are giving it up just to, like, own the libs far too easily. You know, Trump supporters understand he's lying constantly, but think it's cool. They think it's cool because it you know, triggers the libs. But, you know, if we all step back, Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, and say, how about we go back to a culture where we just focus on the truth and it's not about, like, humiliating people anymore, because that's not a politics, actually. Politics should be like, here's this, you know, let's talk about a $1 wage raise. Let's talk about the weekend and how we're losing the weekend. Like, I kind of like the weekend. It took the unions a long time to get us the weekend. Let's hold on to the weekend, you know, and it, to get people back to that level and to get people back to respecting the truth, it's a humble thing. It's a little thing, but it's the center of democratic culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think about this. It's, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about, you also go into a section in your book where you talk about that thinking of the normalcy of fascist ideology, you know, that there's a normalization of that going on, and it's very dangerous. And if you think about that, you bring up the term American exceptionalism, and it's constantly brought up generation after generation, and this is very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. So part two of Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism is called imperialism. M.A. Césaire in Discourse on Colonialism speaks regularly about, he says, Hitler's the worst person on earth, not because of what he did, but because of who he did it to, Europeans. He was doing to Europeans what the Belgians had done in the Congo when they killed 10 million people, like imperialism. And Hitler, of course, was infuriated, as Du Bois and The World in Africa brings out, was infuriated by the loss of the German colonies in Africa. Imperialism, the idea that the world is yours, is a very dangerous thing. So 9/11 really triggered a lot of what's happening now. Because 9/11 was, we lied ourselves, we got comfortable lying ourselves into a colonial war. We sold ourselves on we're spreading democracy. And here's the thing. I mean, Trump was very sophisticated about this, and I respect him immensely for the intelligence this took. He said, we're not good. Look at the Iraq War. So that always happens. When you become hypocritical with your colonialism, when it becomes just too obvious that you're not spreading democracy, you're in fact crushing people under your boot, then someone is going to come and say, hey, crush, that's what we do. We crush people under our boot. And that's fascism.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so
what
imperialism leads directly to fascism. The Iraq War led directly to our moment.
Boy, that's pretty heavy. Wow. Tell me this. This thing you talk about in the book about fascist inversion and ideas used to undermine themselves. And then I was thinking about that whole process actually can be used to undermine the entire society. You know, these anti-corruption campaigns, the unreality you referred to earlier, and then one something that you also talk about, which we'll get into in a minute, but the victimhood that's actually been really out there now. So let's just first talk about this fascist inversion. What do you mean by that, and why is it so dangerous?
So remember there was a Saturday Night Live early on in the Trump administration where they had the Breaking Bad actor, played the Walter White character, come and as the new head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as a joke, you know, because Trump kept on appointing people who were the opposite of their agencies. Mick Mulvaney was running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Everyone running, he put Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy. I believe the Secretary of Energy. He put people who wanted to dismantle the very agencies they were running as head of the agencies. So he was inverting everything. So fascists run. So I talk about the example. I mean, this inversion point is familiar from literature. George Orwell's 1984, War is Peace. So think about, do you know what the name of Guantanamo Bay is? Camp Justice. So this inversion where you represent things as their opposite. So how was Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, the New York Times investigation revealed the depths of his corruption, of his business corruption. So how is he able to run this anti-corruption campaign? Well, he's able to run it by painting the system as corrupt and rigged. And to be honest, the system had a lot of was pretty corrupt and rigged. But that's very dangerous when that happens. When you can paint the system as corrupt and rigged, then you can run. Then the corrupt candidate becomes like the authentic candidate. He's the one who's openly corrupt, and everyone's like, well, he's obvious. He's not hiding anything. He's openly corrupt. And so they can be the anti-corruption candidate. But it's a joke. Then they run and then they go into office. He's representing the little man. He has a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the oligarchs that fund him and himself. So everything means it's opposite, but it's fine because he's triggering the libs.
Mm-hmm. Boy. All right, I have a couple more questions here for you. And when we're talking about this, and it's part of this thing of, I don't know, it's sort of like the, you know, you've just been talking about a little the politics of fascism, of pollution and corruption, but there's another thing that actually sticks out really, really sharply in relation to Trump and fascism and the situation of people in this country and in the world right now. And in particular, I was really intrigued by this thing of Trump and young black men who, by their existence, their very existence, are violations of law and order, labeled rapists or whatever. Young black men are targets under this fascist stuff.
Right. So things don't mean, under fascism, things mean their opposite. They don't mean, so law and order doesn't mean law and order. So as I talk about in the book, when Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said, you can tell from Trump's response to the Central Park 5 case that he's going to be a law and order president. What was meant by that? The Central Park Five were five completely innocent young black men who were arrested for a crime. They did not commit, and every possible, there was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime. There was the sperm found there was later shown to be the sperm of a convicted rapist who was on a spree at the time. So they were completely innocent, and they got a settlement from New York City. And Trump said, no, they're guilty. New York City shouldn't have paid the settlement. So what does it mean that Sessions said, oh, he's a law and order president? Law and order is punishing, is making sure that people who are guilty for the crimes face, that society is protected from them, and we do something about that situation. It doesn't mean punishing the innocent for crimes they didn't do. Well, law and order under fascist politics means the out-group, the young Hispanic men, young black men, they are, by their very nature, violations of law and order. They're criminals. The Nazis, too, painted the German Jews as criminals. When the Nazis ran, they said, we're going to imprison all the criminal Jews. And many Jewish people said, okay, they're not going after me. But it turned out they meant people with traffic tickets, speeding tickets, exactly what's happening with immigrants right now.
Mm. All right, one last question, and this is one that actually I think it's imperative for people to pay attention to. It's the chapter Arbeit macht frei. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually something that I think in some ways brings together everything that you've just been talking about. So let's get into that.
So Arbeit macht frei is about the fact, so fascism is based on social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is the view that value goes with whoever, with the winner. There's winners, and you always got to, people are channeling social Darwinism when you have politicians talking about winners and losers. If you hear a politician talking about, well, there's winners and there's losers, and I don't like the loser, that's social Darwinism. That's the idea that value only goes with the winners. If you want a good, handy mnemonic to realize how bad that is and how dangerous it is, think of the Nazi T4 program, where they gassed the disabled. Why did they gas the disabled? Because they were the Nazis held they had no value because they couldn't do hard work. So they couldn't fight in a competitive market. So social Darwinism is at the core of Nazism. Now, fascism is not social Darwinism of the individual. So economic libertarianism is social Darwinism of the individual. It, too, I believe, is a dangerous doctrine, but it's an acceptable doctrine to have in a free society. You know, libertarians are anti-fascists because they restrict their social Darwinism to the individual. Fascists say certain groups have more value than other groups. Americans have more value than non-Americans. Whites have more values than blacks. Jews have more values than Palestinians. That's the sort of social Darwinism of the group that you find in fascist thinking. And the idea is, and then there's this fiction that there's this hierarchy of value that's been created by hard work. The in-group, the German ideology was that Germans were hard workers, and they worked hard, and Jews were lazy, and they lived off interest and banking, and so you had to force them to do free labor. So you can distinguish the valuable group, because they're hard workers, from the lazy people. And the lazy people have lesser value. And that's the structure of the hierarchy. The lazy people are rapists and criminals, and they're lazy. The valuable people are hard workers and law-abiding. And that's how you construct the value. And labor unions, they try to make it easier. And we don't want to make the workers' lives easier, because hard work gives you value. Now, in fact, hard work is not at the center of liberalism. Like, it's not the case that you have value because you're better at working longer hours. You have value in liberalism because you are a human being worthy of dignity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason. Anything you'd like to add before we leave?
No, I think that's How Fascism Works covers it, and you've done a great job of asking about its themes.
Thank you, man. I really think people should get this book, check it out, read it, pass it around. Very important, especially in this time that we're living in. So, Jason Stanley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions did not. He has spent the last 10 years studying fascism, and he's produced an incredibly important book that people should definitely check out. Now, for a further understanding of the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime, its roots in the history of this country, and why it's come to the fore at this time, there's an unparalleled resource in this talk by Bob Avakian, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And I also want to play a clip from Bob Avakian and another talk about why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. So check this out.
So let's get deeper into what we need to do now. Let's go back to the crucial point that we need to be serious and scientific. A scientific approach and method leads to the understanding that the basis for revolution lies not in what most people are thinking or doing right now or at any given time, but in the deep and defining contradictions of the system. What is concentrated in the five stops and all the terrible suffering to which this system subjects millions and billions of people, which cannot be eliminated within this system. But this revolution will not be brought about magically or just by the way this system causes people to suffer. This revolution must be consciously and systematically built for from here forward, with ever-growing numbers of people, first in the thousands and ultimately in the millions, who are brought forward into the organized ranks of the revolution to actively work for this revolution. How We Can Win lays out the plan and the means for how we can make this real. First, it is important to understand that although it is true, as I have said in the New Communism, that revolution cannot and will not be made just by spreading the idea of revolution around and perhaps getting some positive responses, thumbs up. At the same time, however, it is also true that spreading the word about this revolution can itself be very important revolutionary work, an important part of building the movement for revolution. The fact is that among those who really need to know about this, including those who most desperately need this revolution, very few have even heard about it. And they are living with the belief that this world as it is the only one that's possible. And for many, this means that on top of being subjected to continual brutality, degradation, and torment, they are suffocated by the lack of hope. Raising people's sights to the possibility of a radically different world can not only bring hope to people on a scientific basis, but can also awaken a potentially powerful force for the revolution that could make this hope a reality. For these reasons, we need to be on a mission to spread the word, to let people know that we have the leadership, the science, the strategy and program, and the basis for organizing people for an actual emancipating revolution. Here again is the importance of the point I emphasized earlier about the great strengths we do have and what is still missing, masses of people who catch the worst hell under this system and those who were sickened by the endless outrages perpetrated by this system, who need to be brought forward wave after wave and develop into conscious revolutionaries and revolutionary leaders. Spreading the word, particularly as this is done together with others in a planned, systematic way, can be an important step in joining the organized ranks of the revolution and taking part in the process of building the revolution. A crucial next step in making this revolution real is that thousands need to get organized into the ranks of the revolution now, while millions are being influenced in favor of this revolution. Getting organized into the ranks of the revolution means acting together with others in a unified way, as an organized force, guided by the strategic plan and leadership for the revolution, building the revolution among broader masses of people, while also getting deeper into the principles, methods, and goals of this revolution, the basics of which are concentrated in the points of attention for the revolution. A key form of revolutionary organization are the revolution clubs, which live by, propagate, and fight for those points of attention. The core of the revolution clubs are people deeply committed to revolution who closely follow the leadership of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which has the basis in the new communism to provide overall leadership for the revolution. But the revolution clubs also need to reach out to and involve growing numbers of people who are new to the revolution. The revolution clubs are a means through which people can take part in and powerfully represent for the revolution in an organized way as they learn more about the revolution and advance toward joining the party. Networks of people working together to spread the word about and organize people into the revolution need to be built and expanded in all parts of the country and linked together. In areas where the party and the revolution clubs have not yet established an organized presence, or in circumstances where people have not yet come into direct contact with this organized presence of the revolution, but have become aware of the core principles and goals of the revolution, they should reach out to and involve others they can draw forward around those core principles and goals. They should link up with the central leadership of the revolution for assistance and direction in organizing a revolution club among the people they are bringing into the revolution on the basis of the points of attention for the revolution, which are included in the pamphlet, How We Can Win, and are posted at revcom.us. A crucial connecting link in all this is the party's website, revcom.us, and newspaper, Revolution, which sharply expose the crimes of this system, scientifically analyze why it cannot be reformed, and give guidance and direction for people to work in a unified way for the revolution. In everything we do, it needs to be kept clearly in mind and boldly put forward to people that whatever part of the country we are in, and whatever the size of our forces at any given time, we are doing all this as part of a national movement, together with people in other parts of the country, aiming to impact all of society and building a revolution to overthrow the whole system with the whole world in mind. An important principle and method in organizing people into the revolution is the understanding that while revolution requires serious commitment, people's level of commitment will, at any given time, essentially correspond to and be grounded in what aspirations have been awakened or brought forward in them, and what they are coming to understand is required in relation to that. And this commitment should proceed from what people themselves have been won, yes, through struggle, even at times sharp struggle, to see as a necessary and essential contribution to the revolution. People can start with basic tasks that they can readily carry out and feel confident doing, which make a real contribution to building the revolution. And they can learn to take on more responsibility as they gain more experience and a deeper understanding. The important thing is that they are part of the process of building the revolution together with others. These principles and methods should be kept clearly in mind and applied at all stages of people's involvement with the revolution to enable them to continue in advancing in understanding and commitment.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what we need to do now from his recent talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And when you're thinking about this, okay, when you're thinking about what you just heard from Avakian, and then think back again, too, on the conversation we just had with Jason Stanley, all about fascism and how fascism is, you know, in my mind, fascism is like, look, we're living in a fascist country right now. We're living in a fascist country that is consolidating its fascism on every front and every day, every move that Trump makes and all these people, that's where they're going. That's what they're doing. And you have to listen to this. You have to listen to what Avakian's saying, what Jason was saying. And then you have to make a decision about what you're going to do about this. All right, and that's extremely important. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with our next guest. And our next guest is Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So don't miss that. All right, welcome back. Yeah, and that was Function Underground with We the People and various other people in it. All right, and the thing just gets me. It just sends me someplace else all the time. All right, and so my assistant producer has to come banging on the window telling me, hey, come back to the world. Anyway, you know, we've all watched what happened with the arrest of Julian Assange, and we've all watched with, I hope, a certain amount of, you know, horror at the way Assange has been treated, not only by the authorities and by the U.S., but if you look at what the U.S. has got in store for him, if you look at what the British have done to him, and you look at what they're actually going after him for in terms of what he did in relation to Chelsea Manning and the whole thing, the way he broke open a lot of the horrors and the crimes that the U.S. was committing. Back in the war on Iraq and all the rest of this. And when you think of all that, I found an article that was from someone we've had on the show before. His name's Trevor Timm, and I was really interested in hearing what he had to say because the title of the article is Assange's Indictment is Trump's Next Step in His War on Press Freedom. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, there's this whole thing. There's this disgusting kind of nitpicking or whatever it is, you know, like just sort of whining about, oh, Julian Assange, he's so disliked, all this other stuff. You make it's almost like calling on people to forget about Assange. What difference does it make? As long as our butts are clean, what difference does it make? And you make a point that you say to people, please do not fall for this trap. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, anytime our government or any government wants to curtail the rights of all people or all journalists, what are they going to do? They're not going to go after the most popular person in the United States or a legacy media organization like the New York Times. What they're going to do is go after somebody like Julian Assange. I mean, you know, Julian Assange has done many good things as far as publishing goes, and you could argue he's done many bad things. But the crux of the matter is he is fairly unpopular now, and the Trump administration has figured that if they can bring charges against him, maybe the public will react in a positive or neutral way, that they won't see the extreme dangers of prosecuting Assange for his actions in publishing documents with WikiLeaks, and that they can then use that precedent to go after other journalists. We know that the Trump administration obviously hates press freedom. You know, Trump constantly goes on Twitter tirades about the media all the time. But not only that, you know, they have been on pace to prosecute a record number of sources of journalists. He's talked about making it easier to sue journalists for libel, like for stories that he doesn't like. And has even talked to the former FBI director about throwing journalists in jail. And so this Assange indictment, it may actually be the first step in trying to figure out a process for which he can more directly prosecute journalists in the future. And I think that's why, whether or not anybody likes Assange or hates him, that they should be extremely worried about this prosecution.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's very heavy because when you're looking at this, it's sort of like they have done already. I mean, picking Assange to, you know, to go in, grab, make all this stuff, all this uproar about it and all this other thing. You know, at the same time, what they're not saying, although, it's sort of as Trump has made it clear that he is furious. And you make this point in your piece that you wrote. Trump has been clear that he's furious about leakers and that the news organizations that publish him ever since. And he's furious with the news organizations as well, ever since he took office. And he complains about it, you know, in his Twitter tirades. But he's actually more than complaining. He has actually directed the Justice Department to stop leaks. And he's actually, I think this point that you were making about, look, the door is open to a certain extent for Trump and the people that run the U.S. fascist regimes. What are they going to do? You know, they have the freedom to do certain things on this. They have the freedom to actually make moves that could, you know, if you think about it, the upheaval brought on by that could be very, very important in terms of the existence of a press that's actually telling, that's trying to tell the story, trying to tell the truth, and a people who is, you know, informed of what's going on and being able to make choices about what's right and what's wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Donald Trump, as you mentioned, has constantly not just complained about leaks coming from his administration, but has publicly directed the Justice Department to do something about them. And whether or not this administration or any administration likes leaks, the fact of the matter is that leaks are vital to our democracy. You know, the press acts as kind of the safety valve when the checks and balances of our government break down and can bring accountability to issues that otherwise wouldn't see it. And Trump clearly has been preoccupied by leaks for just about as long as he's been in office. And, you know, in some sense, it seems like they're driving him somewhat crazy because he has this hatred for the media. There is an opening now for him to potentially use this WikiLeaks prosecution as kind of a backdoor way into making it easier to prosecute journalists, the New York Times, the Washington Post, or whoever has made him angry on a particular day. And the indictment of Assange, which I think we can get into a little bit soon, you know, thankfully does not make the act of publishing illegal. But what they are essentially trying to do with this indictment is criminalize a lot of news gathering behavior that is common to many journalists. So, for example, using an encrypted chat program, protecting your source's anonymity, or inferring that you need more information or documents from a source, which reporters do all the time. And so it should be quite worrying to all journalists, again, even if you dislike Assange, and even if you don't think Assange himself is a journalist. Just because you don't think that he is a journalist doesn't mean that this precedent can't be used against other journalists, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into what you just raised, because, you know, when you're talking about that, I was thinking, yeah, let's jump into this. You know, the part.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the indictment, mm-hmm. You know, I think immediately when it was released, there were a lot of journalists who only read the headline of the Justice Department's press release. And so what the press release essentially said was that Julian Assange is being indicted for a conspiracy to hack. And, you know, naturally, a lot of people's reactions to that is, oh, journalists don't hack documents, you know, and this isn't about publishing. So we shouldn't have to worry. And so we can, you know, either ignore this or even celebrate it. But that actually couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, first of all, as far as we know, Julian Assange did not actually hack anything. The charge itself is fairly weak. What happened was that, at least if you were to believe what the Justice Department says, which I think we should all take with a grain of salt anyway, is that Chelsea Manning was trying to break some sort of password back in 2010 when she had already given hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks. She had passed along the what's known as the hash of this password to Assange, and Assange said something like, I'll look into it. And the Justice Department doesn't even allege at all that he ever broke the password. They also don't allege that this was even meant to be used to gain access to more documents. Chelsea Manning had already sent him most of the documents that she had. And it was really just about protecting her anonymity. But the real problem with this indictment is not necessarily just that charge, but basically everything that is written around it. Instead of just focusing on this one act between Chelsea and Assange, what they do is then bring in all of this other normal journalist source communication rituals that that any journalist would recognize as something as part of their job. So the Justice Department claims it's part of the conspiracy that they were using an encrypted chat messenger. This is something that journalists use all the time. I mean, Signal, the text messaging application, is pretty much standard practice for journalists these days. And then they talk about how Assange wanted to redact the name, the usernames, and any identifying material on the documents that could lead back to Chelsea. Now, of course, journalists protect sources' anonymities all the time as well. If you want people to come forward, you're going to have to protect their anonymity, especially when they're facing retribution like Chelsea Manning did. And then there is the question of the Justice Department saying that Assange was furthering this conspiracy by not even directly asking, but suggesting or inferring that he would like more documents from Chelsea Manning. And, you know, as any reporter worth their salt knows, oftentimes you can't just wait for things to magically fall in your lap. If you're talking with a source who's given you more information, you may need to go back for clarification. You may need to go back and ask if they have any more material. And it's these types of things that are wrapped around this conspiracy charge. They could potentially criminalize a lot of news gathering practices by journalists. And it just is another indication that, you know, the Justice Department probably wants to go after Assange because they know that a lot of journalists don't relate to him and may have negative feelings about him. And so they expect that they won't push back hard against this. And my warning to them would be, you should push back on this as hard as you possibly can, as if it was your own colleague or it was yourself, because it's not your colleague now, but your colleague may be next.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're saying that, I really, you know, you were starting to get into what I wanted to wrap up with, and I think we still should explore it a little because, you know, when you're talking about this and you report that CNN has already reported that the Justice Department expects to bring more charges against Assange, and that's coupled with the fact that there was an ominous reference to the Espionage Act in the current indictment, and this all suggests prosecutors might still be thinking about charging him for crimes involving the act of publishing, too. A Rubicon that would be an absolute disaster for reporters everywhere, not to mention all the people who depend on actually having some semblance of truth in the news somewhere. So let's talk about that. We have a few minutes to talk about that now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the real fear of press freedom advocates, you know, that they were going to charge Julian Assange for the act of publishing under the Espionage Act. And that's why a lot of reporters, you know, sort of breathed a sigh of relief when this indictment came down. But that actually might be all part of this plan. When you read the indictment closely, they make this really bizarre citation to the Espionage Act that does not need to be there. And if you read the sentence carefully, it certainly sounds like that they may be preparing other charges that actually might directly go after that particular aspect. And that would be an absolute disaster. You know, there is no story about national security or foreign policy in the last 40 years that has appeared on a front page of a newspaper that did not contain classified information. The First Amendment should protect reporters against prosecution for publishing this type of material. And every single newspaper in the entire country publishes classified information all the time. In that respect, WikiLeaks and say the New York Times are no different at all. And the New York Times lawyers would admit the same thing. And so that is another really concerning aspect of this. You know, maybe they were just bringing this one charge so that they can get the extradition process going, and then later along the line, they're going to bring up even more dangerous charges. Because for all of the energy and resources that they have put into getting Julian Assange, the one charge that they have brought so far is incredibly weak, even if you take away all of the press freedom concerns. And so you have to wonder, you know, what are the other charges they're potentially going to bring against Assange, and how much more dangerous might they be?
Mm-hmm. All right, Trevor, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll stay in touch so we can keep following this. All right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, sure. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's a journalist, activist, and lawyer, and he's been talking with us about the indictment of Julian Assange and the next dangerous steps in Trump's war on the press. And I'm telling you, folks, this is incredibly important. Both the sections that we played today, actually every aspect of the show today was incredibly important. And even as it was unfolding, it became even more evident to me how important this is. And we cannot sit back and just allow things to roll past us without actually taking it all very seriously and acting accordingly. Okay. And I want to thank my engineer today, Teddy Robinson. Hey, Teddy, just a great job again. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little piece I really love, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Y como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.